Today's broadcast was originally recorded on June 3rd, 2024.
I paid hush money because I've had a lot of fun. I fought the law and the law won. I'll be taking naps until it's all done. I fought the law and the law won. Somehow I'm still allowed to run. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. Take me home, mommy. This is too tough for me.
Well, we'll see if the law won. It won so far.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I think.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Know what I
mean? I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us. Yes, we are back. After a sort of a rocky week off, which I will explain in a moment. Desi Doyen, I'm not sure, did anything happen while we were gone?
Just a few things.
If so, if let's say, for example, a former president of the United States was convicted of 34 criminal felony counts for trying to rig the 2016 presidential election.
Oh, yeah. Stuff like
if,
that.
If that happened, if it did, and who knows? I don't know. I wasn't paying attention. I suspect we will get more on that if it did happen from our two guests upcoming who have been regular guests on this program throughout Donald J. Trump's New York criminal trial. They will be joining us once again momentarily in case there was, like I say, anything that happened in that case last week that we may have missed. But I should also note that my hope today had been to open our phone lines to listeners to discuss that very thing. But, well, funny story. About 2 hours after we got off the air from our last show before the Memorial Day holiday, Desi Doyen, hi, Des.
Hi.
Is there a reason you got a mask on today?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, it turns
sure.
out, yeah.
Go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, well, turns out right after we got off the air, Desi tested positive for COVID again.
Yay.
Now, this was your second time since the beginning of the year.
Yes.
When you, I should note, infected me as well, after which, about 2 weeks later, I had a rebound infection. So I got two infections for your one. But the gods seem to be evening things out at this point.
Yes.
So you got the COVIDs. You tested positive right after we got off air. And you immediately got a prescription for Paxlovid, and that knocked it out of you in about, I don't know, 3 or 4 days or so.
Yeah, I felt better immediately, but I did test negative shortly after that.
Right, after the Paxlovid.
Yes.
And then so we did get a few days off, and we were ready to come back, do the show on Monday at the studio at the KPFK, our flagship station here in Los Angeles, when you tested positive yet again.
Yes, yes, I did. I have a rebound infection, which the doctor tells me happens to a certain percentage of people, but it's usually milder, which I am happy to report it is. It's not that bad, but we are going to limit our time face-to-face these days.
In this studio, yeah. And it's actually remarkable that I didn't get it.
So far,
I didn't catch it from you the first time. Well, the first time you had it over the past week or so, and now this rebound infection. So far, so good, but that may only last as far as I allow you to stay in this studio, which you will be leaving shortly. But that's why we couldn't go to the station, because apparently Desi doesn't mind making me sick, but she doesn't want to make everyone else at the station sick, which is very thoughtful of her. So hopefully you'll be getting better soon. You can't take Paxlovid after you took it so recently.
Correct.
Before, right?
Yes.
So you're on your own here. Hope you're feeling better and hope I am still feeling okay over the next few days. We will find out, I guess, soon enough. So, but that's why if we don't show up on the air at some point over the next few days, it's probably because I got sick as well. Anyway, so we will be getting Desi out of this room very shortly when we will be joined by attorney Keith Barber and columnist Heather Digby Parton instead of callers, which we had hoped to take. But we will try to do that when we can, you know, get back to the station when and if this latest COVID wave finally blows over. And by the way, Desi, I understand you're not the only one getting COVID lately, that there is a new wave that's sort of happening with a variant that is said to be no worse than previous ones.
It's sort
of mild form as far as symptoms go, but that it is more virulent.
More infectious. It is more likely to infect people, which I discovered.
Great.
Yes.
Great. Fantastic. In the meantime, very quickly, voters in Iowa, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota, and the District of Columbia are heading to the polls on Tuesday for primary elections. Yes, even though the two presidential candidates are, at least in theory, already chosen by the voters for this year's presidential contest, there are still congressional, state, and local primaries happening all summer long. And in this case, on Tuesday, in five states and D.C., Iowa, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota, and D.C., if you live in one of those states or in D.C., I hope you will exercise your right to vote and, in the bargain, make sure that you are registered as you think you are before this November's incredibly critical presidential election on November 5th. Remember. But over the weekend, just south of the border here, voters across Mexico were casting their ballots in a presidential race that made some history. Mexico's projected presidential winner, Claudia Sheinbaum, well, that doesn't sound Mexican, will become the first female president in the country's 200-year history. She will also be the first person from a Jewish background to lead the overwhelmingly Catholic country. And I suspect in what may make Desi Doyen very happy, the first climate scientist elected as president of Mexico, or president of any country, I think, for that matter.
Yes.
Can you think, has there been any other climate scientists
there have
as
not
president?
There have not been any other climate scientists, although Margaret Thatcher was a credentialed scientist when she was prime minister of Britain. And Angela Merkel, the prime minister of Germany, was also a credentialed scientist when she was elected.
The former prime minister of Germany, we should
note.
Yes.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, in Mexico, Sheinbaum, the apparent successor of outgoing and very popular President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, according to early reported results, vowed to continue on the direction set by the populist leftist leader. But the cool-tempered scientist, as AP describes her, offers a sharp contrast in style and a break with Mexico's male-dominated political culture. The National Electoral Institute's president said Sheinbaum had between 58 and 60% of the vote, while opposition candidate Sotil Galvez, I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that name properly. Glad she didn't win, because I would have never been able. Anyway, she received between 26 and 28% of the vote, and Jorge Alvarez Meynez had between about 10 and 11% of the vote. Sheinbaum's Morena Party was also projected to hold its majorities in both chambers of Congress. The climate scientist and former Mexico City mayor said that her two competitors had called her and conceded her victory. Oh, is that how it's supposed to work? The fact that the two leading candidates were both women had left little doubt that Mexico would make history on Sunday, and in fact, it did. Quote, as I have said on other occasions, I do not arrive alone, said Sheinbaum shortly after her victory was confirmed. We all arrived with our heroines who gave us our homeland, with our mothers, our daughters, and our granddaughters. Sheinbaum will start her six-year term on October 1. Mexico's constitution does not allow re-election of a president, even as López Obrador would almost certainly have easily won re-election had he been allowed to run. The leftist Sheinbaum has said she believes the government has a strong role to play in addressing economic inequality and providing a sturdy social safety net, much like her political mentor. López Obrador's anointed successor, the 61-year-old Sheinbaum, consistently led in polls despite a spirited challenge from her opposition. If the current margin holds, with about 50% of the vote tallied, it would be López Obrador's it would approach López Obrador's landslide victory back in 2018. The elections were widely seen as a referendum on López Obrador, a populist who has expanded social programs, but has largely failed to reduce drug cartel violence in Mexico. His Morena Party currently holds 23 of the 32 governorships and a simple majority of seats in both houses of Congress. Sheinbaum promises to continue all of López Obrador's policies, including a universal pension for the elderly and a program that pays youths to apprentice. Just as the upcoming November rematch, they note, between U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump has underscored deep divisions in the U.S., Sunday's election in Mexico revealed how severely polarized public opinion is in that country over its direction, including its security strategy and how to grow the economy. But there you go, a successful election in Mexico, at least as far as we know, at least as far as it has been counted so far, with the opposition conceding that they lost and the peaceful transfer of power already underway.
Wow, what a concept.
I know. Who can imagine such a thing?
But I do want to point out one important thing, that Mexico currently is experiencing a record heat wave and Mexico City is on the verge of running out of drinking water.
Oh,
so it's a good time to hire a climate scientist to run your government.
Yeah, it is. I guess she won't be a climate denier running the country.
At least there's that.
We'll take it. But speaking of the November rematch between U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, I should say, and now, as I've heard, convicted felon Donald Trump. Let's take a quick break here. We will throw Desi out of the studio. I will try to do this myself for the rest of the way as much as I can, and we will come back with thoughts on the jury's historic verdict last week in Donald Trump's first of four currently scheduled criminal trials. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast. Yes, he is. As you may have heard, Donald Trump is not just guilty of a crime, he's guilty of 34 of them. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yes, Donald Trump has finally won the popular vote, and it was finally a landslide when 12 New Yorkers, a jury of his peers in the city he grew up in, voted unanimously on Thursday to find him guilty of 34 separate criminal felony counts related to his hush money payment to a porn star to help him, yes, successfully rig the 2016 presidential election in his favor. That after spending months telling us that, in fact, the 2016 election was rigged against him. Until, of course, he won it and then decided it wasn't rigged against him after all. That before he would then go on to lose the 2020 election and claim that it was rigged after and before two impeachments that he also claimed were rigged, before several civil lawsuits that he lost claiming they were rigged against him, and four criminal indictments, each one rigged, 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 and finally, at least for now, 34 felony convictions at a trial that he claims was, yes, say it with me, rigged. None of those claims, none of those lies, however, changed the plain fact that he was found guilty by a jury of his peers on all counts after a fair 6-week trial and just 2 days of deliberations by that jury. Donald Trump, the former president and presumptive Republican nominee for the 2024 presidential election, is now a convicted felon, and his party, not just his brain-poisoned cultish MAGA followers, but his party and its top elected officials have all come to his aid to repeat his evidence-free claims of a rigged election, a kangaroo court, a biased judge, and a prosecutor that he falsely claims, let me say that again, falsely claims ran on the promise of indicting and convicting Donald Trump. That would be Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who did no such thing, even though supposedly moderate Republican U.S. Senator Susan Collins of Maine released a statement on the day of the disgraced former president's felony convictions, claiming that Bragg, quote, campaigned on a promise to prosecute Donald Trump. That is a lie told by Donald Trump repeatedly and, yes, repeated by his followers. It is false. Just like all of Trump's other claims that Susan Collins and the entirety of his party's top elected and unelected officials alike have to date claimed as the basis to call this an unfair trial on charges that should never have been brought. Claims made by a party which for decades had sold itself falsely, but the corporate media played along with it anyway, as the party of law and order. What happened to you, Republicans? Asks columnist Danny Westneed at the Seattle Times over the weekend. Your standard bearer tried to overturn the 2020 election and has now been convicted of illegally influencing the 2016 election. His company was convicted of 17 felonies for tax fraud. He has been found civilly liable for sexual abuse and corporate fraud, and now joins his former campaign manager, deputy campaign manager, national security advisor, multiple former election law attorneys, and a personal lawyer, all as current or former felons. Sensing a pattern here? As Westneed observed in December, anytime Trump or his minions go before a judge or a jury, they have lost. That is the quiet engines of democracy pushing back. While opponents of the former president have been celebrating Trump's criminal conviction since last week, many have also described the moment as a sad one in U.S. history. Sad that it has finally come to this. For the first time in our nation's some 250 years that a president has been held to criminal account for his actions. I disagree. It is not sad in the least. Perhaps it is sad for the Republican Party, but not for the Republic. Much as Trump's minions have gone on the vicious attack against the verdict, against the court, against the rule of law itself since the verdict was handed down, as a signal to any Trumper who might dare to actually honor and respect a verdict of an impartial jury after a fair trial, a signal that speaking out in such a way would be a crime against dear leader that would not be tolerated. In the way that they hoped to send that message about their new position on the rule of law as it applies to them, the nation has now sent a frankly long overdue message to U.S. presidents and to aspiring U.S. presidents that criminality will not be tolerated by the American people. That is a message that, had it been sent long ago against previous presidents who committed crimes while in office, may have helped us to avert the, yes, rigged presidency of Donald Trump and the past near decade of a nation spiraling toward the brink of constitutional collapse and potential civil war because of it. Accountability for the powerful who abuse their power is never sad. It is, as in this case, long overdue. Over the past 6 weeks or so of the first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president, we have been joined each week, or nearly each week, by two very smart friends and observers of this sordid affair about the criminal cover-up of a sordid affair, to discuss the trial proceedings and to help us make sense of it all. After a week off last week during our holiday break when the verdict was finally handed down, there is much for us to discuss today in what is likely our final New York Trump trial catch up with a K episode. But we're happy to welcome back Heather Digby Parton, award-winning salon columnist and proprietor of Digby's Hullabaloo blog, and Keith Barber, former attorney and lifelong Republican who now blogs on the law and Constitution at the progressive website Daily Kos. Welcome back, guys. Great to have you both here.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Fred.
I would like to get your thoughts on the so-called sadness of this verdict and other responses coming from both Democrats and anti and pro-Trump Republicans shortly. But let me start with your initial reactions to the verdict on Thursday as it was handed down, which was at least one day earlier than I had actually expected it to come down, and what we might take away from that alone. Let me start with you, Heather.
Well, I mean, the first feeling that I had was relief, because I figured that it coming in as, you know, reasonably quickly as mm-hmm. it did probably indicated that it wasn't a difficult case for them to decide, which in my view, having, you know, watched the trial unfold through the reporters and all the people who were there in the courtroom mm-hmm. seemed pretty clear cut. But I was relieved, because I wasn't sure of that, and nobody should ever be sure of that, right? I mean, you can't know ahead of time, and what I was seeing, you know, I've learned over these years, especially the last, you know, 8 years of Trump, that, you know, there's no predicting how people are going to react to anything to do with him. He seems to have some kind of, you know, unusual ability to make people, you know, lose their minds.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't know. So, you know, so I was relieved. And I also, you know, obviously, I feel like the reason that happened, and I'll be interested to hear what Keith has to say about this, because he's the lawyer. But I really felt like this was, you know, from what I could glean from the reports, this was a matter of, you know, excellent lawyering on the part of the prosecution with, you know, a very good set of facts, and also, you know, a problematic witness or two that they managed to you know, present a case that was very compelling, as opposed to the case to the other side, which where you had a defendant who was clearly ordering his lawyers to botch the case for his own purposes. You know, yeah. he insisted on denying that he had had an affair with Stormy Daniels when he should have just stipulated to it. And then they could have just dispensed with that part of the trial.
Yep.
And then, you know, weird stuff like calling Costello and all that. I wrote a whole piece about this. I mean, it was just crazy. Even from a non-lawyer's point of view, you could see that the defense was being run by none other than Donald Trump, the man who is clearly not a professional lawyer.
No,
so,
and who
you
ran,
know, that was how I saw it.
And who ran it into the ground the way he's run everything else
everything.
Into the ground that
yeah,
he has
including,
ever
yeah,
run.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
It's just another bit of evidence that Donald Trump cannot run anything,
no.
including his own defense.
Correct. Keith Barber, as a trial attorney who's overseen cases related to fraud, you were you caught by surprise, either as to the timing of the verdict coming as quickly as it did, or by the verdict itself, which, you know, during the trial, you and I both pointed out some weaknesses in the prosecution's case. Did any of that take you by surprise last week?
Yeah, a little bit. I was surprised it was as quick as it was, and I guess so was the judge and everybody else, because the judge was about to send the jury home for the day when mm-hmm. the jury suddenly said, we've got a verdict.
Right.
But I think Heather's right in a sense. Trump here got out-lawyered again, though it's really not fair to pin that on his lawyers. I think a lot of that, as I've repeated many times, was that the lawyers were doing what he wanted rather than exercising what they knew to be sound trial judgment mm-hmm. and procedure. And, you know, it caught up with him. I thought that his lawyers did their best job, actually, at closing. And so their closing arguments, I thought, were pretty effective, as good as they could be. And so that had me worried a little bit. And then, of course, you know, Bragg's team got up and did 5 hours worth of closing arguments and walked through all those documents again, and I think won the jury back. But, you know, you saw the jury question things and ask the judge questions. Mm-hmm. They were focusing on the right stuff. They weren't focusing on whether or not Trump had an affair with Stormy Daniels. They were focusing on the documentation and you know, the causing of fraud, and they were focusing on, you know, the proof beyond reasonable doubt standard and all those sorts of things. So they were, you know, taking it seriously. I don't think that they viewed themselves as, you know, liberal rubber stampers for anyone. I think that they sat back and adjudicated the case according to the facts and the judge's instructions and came to a fair decision.
Heather, since our former president has been officially determined to be a convicted felon at this point, I have seen many in the, as I mentioned in the opening, many in both the corporate media and in the Democratic Party itself refer to it as a sad day. Now, as noted, I don't find it sad at all. I find it long overdue, not just for Trump, but for any president. Yes, including Democratic ones who have violated the rule of law without facing accountability. Isn't such a finding, doesn't it send a good message about the health of our democracy, our republic, and our Constitution, at least for now?
Well, I think so. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I I'm never a person who, you know, when somebody's found guilty or when an execution takes place or something, that stands up and runs around cheering and, you know, being, this is the happiest day of my life. I mean, I don't really react to those things that way. It's sober, but it is not sad. It's serious. And it was a serious final. In fact, I think I wrote this on Twitter the minute that I heard the verdict, you know, finally, a little bit of accountability.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that we should be happy that our system has the ability to actually do something like this. I mean,
and
this
accountability,
is a, you know,
accountability, not just for him, not just for Trump, but for somebody as powerful as Trump,
sure,
as a U.S. president.
And sort of just saying, you know, again, sort of reiterating this idea, which used to be in my memory, mm-hmm. that was just kind of a given in American life, that we believed in the idea that there no man was above the law. Mm-hmm. And you know, this was just fundamental to our American, you know, philosophy, that no man is above the law. And I think, you know, we all went through life thinking that that's the way it was. Well, Trump has and continues, by the way, this is just one step along this road, to challenge that idea. I mean, he has made arguments and continues to make arguments that he is above the law, that he should be above the law, that he's a special person. And not just because he's president, but, you know, in many cases, just because he's him, because that's a lot of the basis of his argument.
Yeah.
Oh, they're going after me because they don't like me and I'm special and I'm being treated differently because I'm me. You know, look at me. I'm me. I mean, this is the lament of a narcissist.
It's the lament of a narcissist, but it's also the lament of really any president might have made had they been charged with a crime. And I can think of a lot of presidents who could have been charged with a lot of crimes. It just feels to me like it should be celebrated that the people have pushed back and said, no, we are not going to tolerate that. You can even a president can be held accountable. Keith, Barber, you're a former lifelong Republican. Did you know that your party was apparently just kidding when it pretended to stand for the rule of law and claimed to be the party of law and order? Because I knew they were pretending, but did you?
No, I believed it was genuine, and I think it may have been genuine now. It certainly is not now. I can tell you that on the evening of the verdict, my wife and I did over dinner have a toast, and what we toasted to was not a conviction. What we toasted to was to justice.
There you go.
It was as simple as that.
Uh-huh.
But you know, Donald Trump now has got more, you know, felony count convictions against him than Baskin Robbins has flavors. And you know, you asked if it's a wonderful affirmation of our democracy and rule of law. It may be an affirmation of the rule of law, but man, given the reaction to it, I don't think it reflects a healthy democracy.
Well,
a month from now, this guy's going to be nominated to be the Republican presidential candidate, and he's still a viable candidate.
Let's talk about that reaction. And actually, I want to talk about it on both sides, both the Republicans' reaction to it and the Democrats' reaction to it. So, Keith, you know, back when you were a Republican, back, let's say, in the Bill Clinton, George W. Bush era, if this situation had been reversed, let's say, and Bill Clinton was running for re-election after being found guilty on 34 criminal counts, what would be the refrain from the Republicans during that campaign against Bill Clinton, you know, on the campaign trail? Would they have been solemnly respecting the court ruling but not made too big a deal of it, you know, to not make a mockery of this solemn, sad event? How would they have run against a Democratic nominee charged, convicted of 34 counts?
Yeah. Well, you know, and Clinton was found in civil contempt of court with essentially the judge, you know, finding him guilty of all the elements of perjury.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I mean, that did happen.
He copped a plea, too, by the way. I mean, at the end of his, he copped a plea and they gave up his law license and all that. So there was some accountability.
Because none of that was before, I don't think any of that was before his reelection campaign, correct?
No.
Right, okay.
Yeah. But. You know, I supported his impeachment because I believed he was guilty of the crimes charged.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what Trump said. Trump said that just the mere possibility that Hillary Clinton could be investigated for criminal crimes should have been disqualifying for her because, you know, you couldn't put the country through that.
Right.
And look at him now. He's convicted. 34 counts of felony fraud.
Right. She couldn't run simply because she was being investigated.
Yes.
She was never charged. And by the way, he was also being investigated at that very same time. We just didn't know about that investigation.
Yes, that's one of my favorite things to talk about is the fact that the FBI put its thumb on the scale in favor of Trump in the 2016 election.
Yep.
And in the MAGA mythology, the reverse is true.
And by the way, in the MAGA mythology, that would be a rigged election, rigged by Trump with the hush money payments, rigged by the FBI, et cetera. But, you know, we never talk about that rigged election. Heather, have Democrats figured out how to run on the fact that their opponent in the presidential election is guilty of 34 felony counts yet. I mean, this shouldn't be hard. Have they figured it out? If not, will they?
It sure doesn't sound like it. I just watched a whole segment on CNN of them interviewing House members. One of them said, oh, we shouldn't talk about it. We need to talk about kitchen table issues.
What?
And, you know, all the things. Yes. Another one said, well, I don't really think we need to go hard after this. And then another one says, yes, we should mention it every chance we get. So clearly there is no consensus there. And I think that is crazy. I am absolutely in favor of mentioning this. This is, you know, this is one of the things you see. You see certain people who, analysts who are following the actual electorate that are looking at, you know, the people who are going to make the difference. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows at this point that there's a hardcore MAGA base and that they are probably, you know, most of the Republicans are going to be there. The left, we've got, you know, most Democrats are on board with Biden. Neither side necessarily is 100% thrilled, but that's just where it's going to go. So it's going to be a close election decided by a certain number of swing voters in the middle, many of whom are kind of soft Trump voters. They're voters who voted for Biden in 2020, and they're kind of contemplating voting for Trump in 2024. These voters are ones who have expressed the fact that if he's a convicted felon and what Keith just talked about, the idea that, oh, God, this is going to be a mess if he gets in, it's going to be nuts, I don't want to go through that again. That whole kind of idea that is in that particular group of people, those people are subject to being convinced over the fact that Trump is a convicted felon. He's got more cases out there. It's never going to end. He's a criminal. No, we can't have that. And that's why the Democrats should hammer that. It's not going to alienate any of their own voters. Not one Democrat who is planning to vote in the upcoming election is going to be alienated because they're saying Trump is a convicted felon. And it's not going to change the minds of any of the MAGA hardcore, but nobody expects that. It's those people. And that is a very potent argument. And they're not going to be convinced by kitchen table issues. That group is not, that's not where they're at all. So, you know, I'm intensely frustrated that the Democrats aren't focusing on the fact that they have a very potent argument that could actually persuade the people who are going to decide this election. It's
insane to even contemplate. That's why I started this question sort of with Keith and with Republicans and what they would do with an issue.
Yes.
I mean, had it been, you know, one felony conviction, much less 34, much less related to sleeping with a porn star before the election. I mean, are you kidding me?
The whole thing, it's just unbelievable. Look what they did with you know, with Monica. This is absolutely ridiculous. And the level of crimes that took place here. I mean, there was a lot of money involved. I mean, nobody seems to think there's, you know, hey, 150 here, 130 here, you know, whatever. That seems like real money to me. And I think it sounds like real money to most Americans. And, you know, the idea that he was involved with this tabloid gossip monger, and they were planting fake stories and doing all this. I mean, at some point or another, you know, the Democrats have got to recognize that they have this bounty that they need to use and not play the Republicans' game. And their own game should be to aggressively go after the criminal that is running in the Republican Party.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in one sense, the question about what Republicans would do in a similar case doesn't make sense, because if a Democrat had been even, you know, accused of something,
wouldn't
like
be nominated.
Or they would, you know, drop out had they been nominated. Now, Republicans have on their side gone hard on the offensive. That's what they do in their defense of the disgraced former president turned convicted felon. On the day after the verdict came down, the nation's top elected Republican, House Speaker Mike Johnson, second in the line of succession to the presidency, had this to say about the verdict.
I do believe the Supreme Court should step in. Obviously, this is totally unprecedented, and it's dangerous to our system. And I think that the justices on the court, I know many of them personally, I think they're deeply concerned about that as we are. So I think they'll set this straight, but it's going to take a while.
Now, he has since sort of walked that back, and I'll play that clip in a moment, because I want to ask Keith about some of this. But Heather, very quickly, your thoughts on those remarks from the Speaker of the House.
Well, it's stunning. And the idea that he would step in, and, you know, ask yourself this, weren't they asking for the Supreme Court to step in before the verdict? Mm. They were waiting for a verdict. And if the verdict had gone Trump's way, it all would have been fine. Mm. Right? They just would have let it go. So okay. This principle that they're relying on is a little bit thin, as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, does Mike Johnson, I mean, how much is he talking to the Supreme Court about this stuff? Is he having dinner with Ginny and Clarence and Martha Ann and Sam? I mean, is that how this is going down? Because that's a little concerning.
That was the most concerning part of that quote.
Well, hang on.
I'm buddies with the Supreme Court justices, and I know they're worried about this. That is frightening.
Well, he sort of walked it back on Sunday on Fox News, of course, after a fair amount of criticism for those remarks, including from our friend and longtime frequent guest on the broadcast, legal journalist Mark Joseph Stern of Salon. Johnson attempted to walk that back, to walk back the initial remarks when he was asked about it by Fox's Shannon Bream.
One of your critics out there, somebody who covers the court with me at part of the Supreme Court press corps, Mark Joseph Stern, wrote this. He says, fascinating to hear the GOP Speaker of the House admit to having private conversations with multiple justices who expressed concern to him about Trump's conviction. I'm sure those justices will recuse from any eventual appeal to avoid sitting on a case they've prejudged. I didn't take your comments to mean that specific conversation, but want to give you a chance to clarify.
No, thank you. Of course, I haven't had conversations with the justices. I just know their character, their personality. I know what they've said in the past. They are deeply concerned, as we are, about maintaining our system of justice. If you walk into the Supreme Court building, Shannon, you and I know, chiseled on the marble above the front door is equal justice under law. They are concerned about maintaining that idea. We all are, because it's a necessary ingredient to keep a constitutional republic. That's what I was referring to. I think they're concerned about using courtrooms for politics and political retribution. We all are. We all should be. Every American. That's what I was referring to. And I think in their heart of hearts, they're concerned about it just like we are.
So there you go, Keith. Feel better about that now?
No.
Why? What?
Yeah, well, first of all, that's just not what he said the first time around, and exactly. You cannot unring that bell. I'm sorry. Not in a situation like this, where everything's on pins and needles, and the Supreme Court is already a suspect, you know, corrupt organization, you know, for the Speaker of the House to be even suggesting that. You know, I know some Supreme Court justices who support my position on Trump on this, which is what he said, is frightening. And no, it doesn't qualify me at all.
It doesn't make you feel better. So with the state criminal case, eventually, I mean, now it's got to go through the appeals process, but will it eventually make its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court? Let's set aside how corrupt they are. Will the case even get there? And if so, Keith, on what basis? It's a state criminal fraud case. What business would the Supremes even have in accepting such a case?
Yeah, they would have to make a federal issue, and the federal issue would have to be the Constitution of the United States. So the most likely thing that they would do is that they would say that in some way, you know, one of the decisions of the judge in the case violated Trump's due process rights and under the Constitution and try and worm it in that way. I mean, that kind of general thing sounds awfully weak to me, you know, particularly after it will have gone through whatever appellate process it goes through within the New York courts. But that's what they're going to try and do. And with this Supreme Court, I don't trust them anymore. I think that, you know, Clarence Thomas and Justice Alito are two of the four votes needed to grant cert on a case, you know, to begin with. And I don't know what they'll do.
Yeah, because we also thought the Supremes would never accept the stupid presidential immunity case. And
that's right. I'm on the record on your show on saying that.
Yeah.
I was wrong. And boy, and that sent a message to me about what we're dealing with this Supreme Court. And, you know, and they're putting their thumbs on the scale now.
Heather, Republicans in Congress now say they want to subpoena Judge Mershon's daughter. Apparently she is a fundraiser for Democratic candidates, as I understand it. What can or should we expect from that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess they can do it, right? I mean, they can subpoena anybody they want.
I guess.
They can, and I guess they'll probably
have to claim that it's in their in the process of creating legislation or something like that.
They're also going to call Alvin Bragg and Mark Colangelo, the other DA.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's for this weaponization of government committee that they're, contemplating writing legislation to stop the weaponization of government. So that's the sort of umbrella that they're going to use to call these people. I won't be surprised if they call them. I won't be surprised if they bring them. It will add up to nothing, of course, because it's completely irrelevant to what they're doing. And it's one of their theatrical performance art pieces, like they had with Anthony Fauci. So,
right.
Great.
Can I comment on that briefly, Brad?
Sure. Go ahead.
I mean, it's an active case, and it's an active case until all of the appeals are done.
Mm.
And certainly it's before the judge now is sentencing. He can't come testify. And all of these guys, Bragg and everyone, should, if they've subpoenaed, motion to quash with the court on grounds that, they can't comment on active cases. And if they lose that, they should come appear before Congress and answer every question with the simple statement of this is an active case and I can't talk about it.
And, there's this idea that, of course, folks on the right are, demanding we must have, more than just strongly worded letters. We must have investigations and prosecutions and hearings and everything else. And Democrats often kind of freak out about that. I don't. I think that's fine. I think investigate who you want to investigate, prosecute who you want to prosecute, impeach who you want to impeach. It never seems to work out well for the Republicans when they do that, when they do things that are baldly, political, whether it's, calling in Hillary Clinton on Benghazi and she puts up with their crap and makes them look like idiots for 11 hours, or if it's impeaching Bill Clinton for something that, in my opinion, was never an impeachable crime, he ends up winning re-election in no small part because of it. So, so I'm not troubled by that. I think it's just fine. Democrats kind of freak out about it. Heather, is it? Should they, toughen up, grow a spine in response to some of this stuff?
Well, it doesn't. I think that they think, and I kind of agree with you. It's fine, and it's fine mainly because, these sort of trumped up, to coin a phrase, investigations that they do are, like I said, are performance art pieces, basically. They don't actually reflect well on them. And I'm not I don't believe that they actually do any real harm to the Democrats. I don't see how there's really a big downside on it. And in fact, they've become quite adept at sort of parrying these charges. I think they've got some good people on the committees who actually do a good job of doing that. So I don't see it as a big thing. I am kind of concerned, though, that Democrats don't use the investigative powers that they have.
Yes.
Obviously, they don't have them now in the House because they don't have the majority, but they do have them in the Senate. And you haven't mentioned this, but it's kind of a big deal that they had how many? 12 Republican senators stage a gigantic, epic temper tantrum over this verdict and said they will no longer cooperate with any legislation until Republicans do something. I don't know what it is that they think supposed to do.
Until they drop, somehow they drop the charges in New York or something.
In
like
New
that.
York. Yeah. Yeah, something, like what? Huh? Okay, sure.
Right.
But they all, it's the MAGA caucus in the Senate that did this. And they put on a big show. And they, a lot of this, of course, as we know, is performing, they're court jesters for King Trump. And they're trying to, curry favor with him. Some of them actually want him to, make him vice president. So, they went and did this thing. And, you just don't. And at the same time, though, you've got this incredible, as Keith was just talking about, this show of absolute corruption on the U.S. Supreme Court, an institution with lifetime appointments And the Senate has a majority, and they have the ability to have hearings, and they have the ability to conduct investigations.
Yep.
And they are barely even making a noise about this stuff.
Yep.
They're barely saying a word about any of this stuff. And they do have the capacity to do it. Now, I know they want to maintain the dignity of the Senate and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we're way past dignity. Okay. Dignity is no longer on the menu. So, you know, it's time to actually do something. And some of this stuff is very important. The stuff that's going on with the Supreme Court is absolutely appalling.
Yep.
And the idea that they would not be calling people, maybe they can't get the justices in there. John Roberts is saying he won't do it. But there's plenty of other people they can call.
Well, by the way,
there are other judges and experts and everybody else who they can bring in and do some hearings. And let's tell the American people what's going on.
I couldn't agree more. And by the way, they could subpoena them, subpoena Alito, subpoena Thomas, subpoena Roberts. They could try
to reject. How about the wives? They can subpoena them.
The wives, exactly. And who's going to make those decisions about whether they have to honor those subpoenas or not? Well, I guess their husbands wouldn't even recuse themselves from that case. But, you know, in all of these, you know, more oversight, more investigation is just fine, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. Because, as I said, when Republicans do it, it seems to sort of fall apart. They had all of these special counsels that they put in charge of investigating Hillary Clinton. All of those trials, the ones that they finally came up with, they all failed. Those trials did not get guilty verdicts, unlike the ones against Donald Trump, because there was nothing there. Now, Keith, we've got just a minute or so here, but the first trial of Hunter Biden, the president's unelected private citizen's son, who was investigated by a Trump-appointed special prosecutor, that trial began on Monday in Delaware on a charge that he lied on a form when buying a gun, claiming he was not using unlawful drugs at the time. In this case, Hunter apparently owned the gun for 11 days. It was never even loaded before his girlfriend then threw it away without his knowledge. Now, I don't believe anyone has found a case where someone has been charged on that crime for lying on that form about using drugs, especially since it includes marijuana, which, you know, everyone uses who buys a gun, I suspect. But, you know, they haven't found a case, I think, where someone was charged for that crime without having committed another crime with that gun, which didn't happen here. So is this the sort of selective political novel application of law that Republicans are claiming to be outraged about as applied to Donald Trump?
Yes. And in fact, DOJ policy says exactly that you won't prosecute under that statute unless the gun involved is itself used to commit violence. So yeah, it's very much political. And you have the judge is a Trump appointee. Nobody talks about that. You know, the judge in New York was not a Biden appointee.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's that. But the judge in Delaware now for Hunter Biden is a Trump appointee. And she recently issued a bunch of rulings against the defense. And some of them sound like they're reaching to me, you know, not allowing an expert witness to testify about how, you know, Hunter Biden's addiction could have affected him when filling out that form and believing that he isn't really addicted or whatever, and some other things. It just has struck me as very bizarre that the gun shop owner modified the form later, and they're not going to allow that modified form in, you know, to show the jury that the guy altered the thing and to try and impeach him on that.
I have a feeling that's not going to go well. And thank you for pointing that out, that a Trump-appointed special counsel is bringing charges against the son of his political opponent, and it's being heard by a Trump-appointed judge. I can only imagine the noise that would be happening had the situation.
Trump would have already pardoned his kid.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. All right, guys. Well, I have to get out here. I want to thank you both for your, I don't know what it is, 5-6 weeks or something, showing up for our Catch Up with K episodes of this New York Trump trial. I have enjoyed it. I suspect we will have reason to bring you both back in the not too distant future, if only because there's three more cases that may someday happen. But until then, just thank you so much, very much for all your support and wisdom over these past few weeks. We will be talking again soon. Heather Digby Parton, the much beloved blogger known simply as Digby over at the Hullabaloo blog, and Heather Digby Parton over at salon.com. You can find her at digbysblog.net and on Twitter at Digby56. And Keith Barber can be found over at dailycoast.com, and where he writes, or blogs, whatever you want to call it, as Keith DB. And he is on Twitter at KeithDB80. Thanks, guys. We'll be talking again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Thanks, Brad.
You bet. Okay. As we wrap up here, by the way, looks like AP is now reporting that a jury of 12 plus four alternates have now been seated in Hunter Biden's case up in Delaware on the first day of jury selection. So that didn't take long, did it? By the way, among the things that Trump has been hoping to mislead Americans about in the fallout, I guess, from his from the jury verdict since then. He's been trying to mislead. For example, I mentioned at the top of this segment that lie that District Attorney Alvin Bragg ran for office on the promise of indicting and convicting Donald Trump. That is not true. That is a lie. You will hear it nonetheless over and over and over again from Republicans. It is simply not true. But in addition to that, is that his defense team had no say about the judge's instructions to the jury. That is also not true. And I've been sort of fighting with the MAGA folks all weekend about it. Both the defense and the prosecution submitted their recommendations for instructions to the judge. He took a little bit from both sides and made his own. And neither the prosecution nor Donald Trump's defense issued an objection to those final instructions. And so, you know, this apparently is news to the MAGA folks. I've been letting them know. They just don't believe me. I tell them, oh, look, check the trial transcripts. You'll see. So there's just a lot of misinformation about there, about all of this. And the defense also had the same say that the prosecution did when it came to jury selection in that case. No, it was not an out-of-control left-wing judge or the prosecution that chose the jury. It was done along with the defense, who had as many rights to object as did the prosecution to various jurors. Amazing the amount of disinformation that Republicans seemed all too pleased to put out there about this trial, even as Democrats, for now, seem to be sitting on their hands and allowing that disinformation to take hold. Again, we have seen this before. All right, anyway, we got a lot to catch up on in the days ahead, so I hope you will join us, presuming I stay well and Desi gets better. Until then, my thanks again to Heather and Keith and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog, and we will see you at all of the above until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.